pastor's absence about our national life. And I've used as the background of that presentation the book of Hosea. And if you would open, please, your Bibles this morning to Hosea chapter 4. We'll have a few words of introduction. And for those of you who don't turn to it nightly in your evening devotion, before bed devotion, it's right after the book of Daniel, after the major prophets of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, then Daniel and Hosea. And I'll give a little bit of background here just to, as part of review, just to get us all on the same sheet of music. We have started this, and it works out very nicely with what our pastor has been going through during both the week and during Sundays, and that is the subject of divine discipline. Because you see, even as there is divine discipline for an individual who rejects God's plan, who refuses to confess his sins and to continue on in apostasy and reversionism, so there is for nations. And of course, with Israel, we are talking about a very special nation. That is God's own chosen nation, God's chosen people, the Jews. And to realize that this was written to the northern kingdom of Israel, if you recall after Solomon, with Solomon's reign, there was a split. After Solomon, there was a split in the kingdom. Judah and Benjamin stayed in the south. They are regarded historically as the southern kingdom. And of course, the 10 tribes up in the north became Israel. And of course, the idea under Jeroboam, they revolted against the Davidic dynasty, the only dynasty that was legitimate for Israel, the only king who was legitimate for Israel, of course, the entire nation, the united nation, was David. And of course, any of his successors. We, of course, look forward to the time when Jesus Christ, the greater son of David, will in fact fulfill all those promises given to David. He was promised a son that would rule forever. And of course, this is all fulfilled in the Lord Jesus Christ. But to realize that Israel, the northern kingdom itself, and this is what we'll be talking about when I say Israel, the 10 tribes, the northern kingdom, also known as Samaria or Ephraim. Samaria was the capital of the northern kingdom, but also referred sometimes to the entire nation. And they had a great many difficulties. As we read this morning from 2 Kings 17, that gives you the historical background of what was going on. They were a nation that had a godly heritage, but they had rejected that. They were going after all kinds of other gods. They were engaging in political alliances, military alliances with the other nations. Realize that the nation of Israel, the Jews themselves, had a king in the first place. Because why? When they went to Samuel, they wanted a king so they could be like all the other nations. But God did not intend for them to be like the other nations. They were to be a special, separated, holy nation unto God. And God did not want them to be like the other nations because of that reason. And the very fact that they represented him, they were to bring God's good news to those nations, to release them, to deliver them from the paganism, the heathenism that they suffered, to bring the news of the Messiah to them. And yet, Israel instead succumbed to the pressure. They, rather than influencing their neighbors, they were influenced by their neighbors. And so they took over all the idols that are found in the surrounding regions. And they engaged in idol worship, Molech, the fire god, the god of Baal, which we find in the book of Hosea here. All these different idols, these different gods, and they all had a cult associated with them. And as we have seen this week with the god Baal, and of course he's a false god, but to refer to him, but he was the god of agriculture and rain and fertility. And so the Jews were celebrating this paganistic god, and of course they were ascribing to him all the glory that should have been due their Lord God of Israel. And to realize that not only, as we read in 2 Kings 17, but throughout various other passages, not only did it involve worship of this false god, but it involved sexual orgies, sexual practices. It involved cult prostitution. There were actually prostitutes associated with this false god. And even as we read in 2 Kings 17, which is just makes me even sick to even talk about, to even think about, to have to even utter the words, but they actually resorted to the point where they would pass their own sons and daughters through the fire. And that was a literal fire. They would actually burn their children in order to evoke religious ecstasy, if you'll pardon the phrase, and the idea of even heightened sexual pleasure. And of course, once these things did not work, they would just search for all kinds of different things. You notice that they were condemned for witchcraft, enchantments, and we'll see that in Hosea 4 later on. And of course, any type of occult practice is condemned by God. In the Old Testament, one who practiced in the occult, witchcraft, demonism, was to be executed, to be stoned to death. So God has a very serious attitude about all these things, and of course, we in our country are simply overwhelmed with all of these things. I mentioned on the other night, I believe many of these children that we see, their pictures on milk cartons, on cards you get in the mail, many of these children have been kidnapped, and we'll never find them. We'll never know the side of eternity, but many of them have been taken by those who are in the occult, those who are satanically inspired to practice human sacrifice. And yes, it does go on today, and it does definitely go on today. And we like to think that we have such a civilized society, but in reality, we have all the same evils that were pictured in Hosea's day. People will say, of course, on occasion, well, the Bible was written so long ago, and I could maybe see a little bit of relevance from the New Testament. We have the words of Jesus and so forth, but this Old Testament stuff is not relevant. The Bible was written so many thousands of years ago. What does it mean to me today? It has no relevance to me today, people will say. And yet, when we look at a book like Hosea, or if you choose Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, any of these different books, you will think that at times you're reading your newspaper headline today, because all the same things that they suffered with, we suffer with today. Man's problems do not change because of technology or society. We simply carry our problem inside of us. That is the old sin nature. And so we have all kinds of problems that we see in the book of Hosea. We see the areas of crime and punishment, or lack thereof in some cases. We see social injustice. We see political intrigue, conspiracy. Of course, the idea of idolatry and drunkenness, demonism, all of these different things that appear in the book of Hosea. And as we have looked at this, I have developed for you the concept. We went through this very quickly. But Hosea was told in chapter 1 to take a wife. And the wife was one of harlotry, or fornication. And this referred to her attitude, something that she was not a prostitute at the time, but she would typify that type of behavior. Excuse me. But the important thing for all of us to realize, even as we sang in the song this morning, "The Church is One Foundation," God's people are often likened in a relationship to God as a marriage. And same with the Old Testament. In the New Testament, we have the church as his bride, of course. But in the Old Testament, we have the same concept. And you see here, we have this lovely woman named Gomer. What a name, huh? But that's just the way it goes. You fathers would not name your daughter Gomer. At least I didn't name mine Gomer, of course. But and I'm being a little bit sarcastic anyway, because she is a woman of unfaithfulness. She was not unfaithful at the time. We have no indication of that, but we've realized that from the Hebrew, we understand to clarify the confusion of the book of Hosea. It's an abstract noun in the Hebrew and refers to her characteristics, or what typifies her. And so Hosea is going to marry her. He was commanded by God to take this woman. And so people have tried to get around that. But it's very simple as it's laid out. Gomer was to be faithful to Hosea, her husband. But instead, she went the other way. She went toward all of her lovers out here. And of course, she was very unfaithful to him. Finally, in chapter 3, he buys her back from a slave market and tells her, "You will be without me or any other man for many, many days." And this was given as a picture of what the Lord was going to do to Israel. Well, the same thing with the nation Israel. They are seen to be in a marriage to God, the Lord God of Israel. They are seen to be in this special relationship. And we find this throughout many, many passages. But instead, Israel went to all of their lovers, that is, their idols. And so the idea of spiritual adultery comes into play here. Idolatry becomes, in effect, spiritual adultery or fornication. And really, we should keep with the word adultery, because that pictures more of the unfaithfulness of the marriage relationship. And of course, Hosea is coming to, as a prophet to Israel, and he is giving these things as object lessons. God is using personal things in his life as an object lesson. And notice how God can be very flexible. God never changes as far as attributes, but to realize that God can do different things at different times. With the prophet Jeremiah, he is told never to take a wife. With Hosea, on the other hand, he is told to take a wife. And all of these things would become pictures or object lessons to the nation of Israel. But at any rate, Hosea was to prophesy to the nation Israel, tell them about their problems, about their sins, to reveal their evil. And of course, being a prophet in the Old Testament was such a popular job. You had the wonderful retirement plan where you might be stoned to death or sawn in half by, Isaiah was by King Manasseh. Jeremiah was thrown into a dark, deep pit. Just wonderful things like that, all because they were told by God, go prophesy to my nation, thus says the Lord. And of course, the truth is never very popular, and as the old adage goes, the truth hurts. And many times it does, even to the point where people react violently. Hosea went to the nation Israel. His ministry lasted a number of years, but if we were to just take a approximate date here, 740 B.C., and then he was, of course, writing these things down. 732 to 723 are the 9 years when the king Hosea, as we read in 2 Kings 17, that was the time of his reign, 732 to 723 B.C. And all of this is tied up in the historical background of what Hosea is talking about to the nation. And it may be 10, 20, 30 years at most before their destruction, before they are swept away by the Assyrians. And of course, we have the same issue today to realize we do not know what the future holds. We don't know what will happen. But to realize that we in the United States face many, many great dangers. We have terrible things going on today, things that are all talked about in the Bible. And of course, we can identify these problems, but even more importantly, the solutions that are involved. And of course, as we've looked at this, we realize that Hosea had this message, and of course, we talk about his personal life in chapters 1 through 3, but then chapters 4 through 14, we have specific prophecies from the prophet Hosea. He does address at times the nation to the south, Judah, because they themselves would have serious problems with these things, but they lasted about 150 years more, and of course, finally, they were destroyed by the Babylonians. But to realize that Hosea is coming to the kingdom Israel, and he's telling them, you have all these problems. And he is trying to lay out why they have these problems. And in chapter 4, we looked at this Thursday night, we actually have the lawsuit against Israel. One would have to wonder if we were to, if we had a, you know, all of us in this church and in fundamental Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, we don't believe that God is still talking to us through dreams, revelations, visions, and so forth. In other words, you do not have, unless you're not sure about this, but you do not have, I do not have, direct conversation with God. Now, if you had one this morning, at any rate, we'll break that down as we go. But to realize that, wouldn't it be interesting to ask God, if we could receive an answer directly from Him and say, God, what do you think about the United States today? What do you think? Oh, there's a groan back there. What do you think about the United States? What are we doing? What are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? And to think about what His answer would be. Well, we don't really have to necessarily get a direct answer from Him because we can extract that from the Word of God. And you see, if we uncover principles throughout the prophets and even into the New Testament, if we are to demonstrate, for example, in society, if we should demonstrate faithfulness and integrity and virtue and honor, and that's found in the Old Testament and the New Testament, then certainly applies to our society today. If we are to have a certain attitude toward crime and to punish criminals and to protect law-abiding citizens, well, we should be doing that. If we're to do this and to do that, you see, we can extract from the Bible all the things that we should be like, and then to turn around with divine viewpoint and look at our society and say, we're not meeting the standard here. We're failing here. We should be doing better here. And so God has laid out for us exactly what we should have and what we should be doing. And, of course, one of the issues that we don't even have the time to develop, but to realize that Israel was a priest nation. They represented God directly. But perhaps in the past you've studied the idea of the client nation. And even though the United States is not Israel, we are not to take the place of Israel, contrary to some. But to realize that we as a nation, we are a special nation blessed by God, founded by His grace. The heritage that we look at with the founding fathers was definitely biblical. Whether they were even deist or not, some of them were deists, but to realize that regardless of that, they had an understanding that God was ordering the events of history, and they wanted to get away from the tyranny of Mother England and to have a freedom that is unsurpassed in the world. And of course, with freedom comes responsibility, and so we have a serious, serious discussion to ensue about that. Well, let's notice chapter 4, verses 1 through 6, and we're not going to stay here a whole lot of time, actually, right this morning. We'll have to come back to it. I said I was going to digress a little bit. But here is, I want to lay this out for you just so we can be on common ground here. We have God's lawsuit, his case against Israel. And the reason I use the word lawsuit or case is because we do find the word reeve used here. It is a legal term used for bringing a lawsuit against someone. And you see, God was able to bring a lawsuit against Israel because they had, in fact, broken his law. They had signed, in effect, to agreement with the Mosaic covenant, all of the laws that were required of them, to realize that God said to the nation Israel, look, very simple, if you obey my laws, you will live in the land. If you disobey my laws, you will die. You will be exiled from the land. And so to realize that Israel had broken these laws, God is laying it out for them through his prophets. Verse 1, listen to the word of the Lord, O sons of Israel, for the Lord has a case, a lawsuit against the inhabitants of the land, because there is no faithfulness or kindness or knowledge of God in the land. And right there we can sum up everything that was going on with Israel, because you see, lack of these virtues, lack of these attributes means overt behavior will flow from them. And when we lack faithfulness, when we lack truthfulness, when we lack kindness toward other people, and especially, most of all, the knowledge of God. And the knowledge of God leads us to freedom in life, to virtue. Then verse 2, excuse me, and I noted this the other night, the words there is are in italics, and they simply don't occur. It's very vivid, dramatic. It simply starts out swearing, deception, murder, stealing, adultery. They employ violence so that bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore the land mourns, and everyone who lives in it languishes, along with the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky. And also the fish of the sea disappear. Yet let no one find fault, and let none offer reproof. For your people are like those who contend with the priest. So you will stumble by day, and the prophet will also stumble with you by night, and I will destroy your mother. The mother here is used for not just the idea of the one's physical mother, but here the mother represents the nation. You see, the nation is seen as the mother of its inhabitants, and of course the citizens are, as it were, the sisters and or the daughters and sons. Verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, because you have rejected knowledge. And this goes back to verse 1, the knowledge of God specifically here. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, that is, of God. Because you have rejected knowledge, I also will reject you from being my priest, that is, my priest nation. Since you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children, that is, the inhabitants of the land. And you see, God is laying out very simply here, because you've forgotten me, you've rejected the knowledge of God, so therefore, all these other things are going on in society, all the unholiness, all the immorality that is seen, so therefore I will reject you and destroy you, God is saying to the nation. Well, this sets the background, and of course there are 14 chapters in Hosea, and to realize that there are so many wonderful details in various places here, but I wanted to look this morning at something that comes up in chapter 10, and I want to delve into this because we've touched on this with the life of David a little bit, but to show you how political intrigue and conspiracy happens here. If you open to turn a few pages, please, to Hosea chapter 10, I want to show you how the Bible speaks to us today. And of course, we're skipping some chapters, and we're probably going to skip around as we go through this, finish up tonight, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. But to realize that Hosea is continuing with the discipline of Israel, he's talking about their various problems. And in chapter 10, verse 1, he says, Israel is a luxuriant vine. He produces fruit for himself. The more his fruit, the more altars he made. The richer his land, the better he made the sacred pillars. And here we have the idea that Israel is often referred to as a vine in many other passages, such as in Psalm 80 and Isaiah chapter 5. But I want you to realize something here. We have the idea that we developed this a little bit the other night. Israel is failing the prosperity test. You know, during the adversity test, it's very easy. We cry out to God. We want God's help. But during the prosperity test, that is when the real danger occurs to us as Christians. And we tend, and even as nations, we tend to forget about God during that time. We want to think, and even Israel, in fact, Moses prophesied this or predicted that it would happen. Israel would be delivered from the Egyptian bondage, the slavery. And he even said, be careful that you do not say in your own hearts, I did this for my own power. And so Moses predicted that of the nation Israel, and this is exactly what happened. And it happens to all of us. In our prosperity, we tend to forget about God. We start to think that we have something to do with it, that we did it on our own power. And here Israel has become very prospered by God's grace, and certainly as we sung this song this morning, America the Beautiful, to realize God did in fact shed his grace on this country. We have been graced out in so many ways, and yet we distort it. We destroyed in so many different ways. And as the more they prospered, the more they gave credit to the idols and built more altars to them. And so they flunked the prosperity test here. And interestingly enough, it says Israel's a luxuriant vine. Actually, we find the final solution to Israel's problem in John chapter 15, because Jesus is the true vine. He will be the one who saves Israel. But to realize that they flunked the prosperity test, and notice this, they gave the more altars they made. Remember I mentioned Baal was the god of agriculture and rain and fertility. He was the storm god also. And you see, they would, this ties right in with it, they would worship Baal, and the more that God prospered them with agricultural prosperity and the fruit of the vine and all these different things, instead of giving credit to God, they gave credit to Baal, who is the god of agriculture. Supposedly, of course, in the ancient pantheon. But, of course, this is part of God's case against them. Notice verse 2, their heart is faithless. Now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars and destroy their sacred pillars. Excuse me. You'll see this phrase, their heart is faithless. They didn't exactly translate it right here. It's literally, their heart is smooth or slippery, which means to be deceitful. And we could even translate this slick. Now, let me think here. Who might typify? I'm thinking, let's see. No one's coming to mind. I'm getting a fuzzy picture. Ah, Slick Willie. Have you ever heard of Slick Willie there? So I told you the other night, he was in the Bible. It was just in the Hebrew here. But what we have is a word here. We have a word, chalak, C-H-A-L-A-Q, and remember we're in the Hebrew now, not Greek, C-H-A-L-A-Q, but it means to be, as I talked about there, smooth, slippery, is how these two words come up with Brown Driver Briggs Hebrew lexicon, the standard lexicon. And so it's smooth or slippery. And then I pulled up the word slippery on my thesaurus and found these related words. Slick, oily, smooth, greasy, slimy, soapy, and hard to grasp. And so if you want to say slick, slimy person, whatever, but that's what happens. Their heart is faithless, or literally is smooth or slippery. And what we have here is the idea in certain passages in Psalms, the smooth lips or tongues. And it refers to deceitful speech. And we have the same concept in English, the smooth talker. You know, the one who just has the words roll off their lips there. And they are able to, what? They're able to con you. They're able to deceive you. And so the con artist, his words are very smooth, and he is able to deceive people. But notice here, we don't have the phrase, their lips are smooth or faithless. Their heart is faithless. And you see what Hosea does here. He skips past the idea of the lips there, but he goes right, if you'll pardon the pun, right to the heart of the matter. You see, if the heart here, which of course is the right lobe, remember we're talking about the brain here, the right lobe, but and of course this is expressed in the lips, but what is in the heart is expressed in the lips and also in action, what you do. And so what is in the heart is deceitfulness. It's smooth talking. It's slippery. They're trying to con God. They're trying to say they really do love him, that they really do worship him. But in reality, they really don't, because they're worshiping all these idols and they're not obeying his law. And so Hosea looks right at the point of the origin of the problem here, and that is the heart. What we think is what we are. And so just because the heart is deceitful and unfaithful, it's coming out through the lips, it's coming out through the action. And of course, as we've seen even in chapter 4, what? The deceitfulness, the swearing, and of course that refers to taking God's name in an oath, a false oath. But the idea of even more overt things, the murder, the stealing, the adultery, and all these different things. And as a man thinks in his heart, so he is, Proverbs 23:7. So the real person is defined, of course, by what we think. The heart, Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart is more deceitful than all else and is desperately sick or wicked. Who can understand it? And so Hosea is hitting right at the point of the problem here, the fact that their heart is faithless or deceitful here. And of course, with the idea that we see this in our society today, you know, I am so sick of hearing this phrase, character doesn't matter. Character does matter. It matters everything, because that is why God is laying a charge against an entire nation and against everybody else in history. Character does matter. And the very fact that we have, and this has gone on for years, but people talk about this, and you see these newspaper polls and so forth, people don't care about the character of a person, just what they will do for them. And to realize that people will talk about these various things, and they say, well, what you do is what counts. It doesn't matter what you are as a person, it's what you do. That is contrary to the Bible. Totally 100% contrary to the Bible. Because the Bible says what you are determines what you do. And you may want to even copy that down in your notes, because that is one principle in life that will definitely cover what you are determines what you do. If you think bad thoughts, you're going to be a bad person. If you think about stealing things, you're going to go out and steal eventually. If you think about murder, you're going to murder. All of these things revolve around as you think, so you are. What you are determines what you do. I was so, as a person who had been in the military, plus as a Christian, I was so disgusted 4 years ago, three and a half, if you'll pardon me, to see what we have done with, for example, the gays in the military. It is absolutely horrible and horrendous. But to realize that President Clinton in his first week made his promises good to the homosexual community to get the gays in the military, to pave the way for that. But to realize, I've heard from so many of these people, and they will, you know, you see them on the TV, whether it be in the Navy, Army, Marines, Air Force, these gay individuals, and I hate to even use that term, because they're not gay. The gay lifestyle is not gay. That's been documented by studies, but to realize that these people are saying, oh, he's such a good soldier. He really was such a good soldier. And his record is just perfect. He's doing such a wonderful job. And you see, having this orientation, being gay, doesn't really affect what he does. Well, let me tell you in a real simple, logical way here, from both a Christian standpoint and military standpoint, how that should be read. A good soldier, first of all, is someone who obeys the rules and regulations of military service. So therefore, if someone, no matter how good their record looks, if they are in disobedience of the military rules, and that is specifically the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which outlaws sodomy, even as of today, then I would submit to you they are not a good soldier. It's that simple. They are not a good soldier. Or sailor, or whatever is the case. It's that simple. Because the military lifestyle demands obedience. Obedience to one's leaders, superior officers, and so forth. And to realize that we have just lost track of what it means to think right, and then to do the right thing. But the idea that character doesn't matter, we've just heard it over and over and over again. And I would submit to you, it does matter. It matters a whole lot, because that's what God looks at with our attitude. So Israel still bears guilt under the divine law of individual responsibility. Everyone has to bear their own guilt and punishment. And of course, the exception is Jesus Christ, who bore our guilt on the cross. So God is going to come down on them. He is going to destroy them. And notice this word, break down their altars here. This is a very vivid word. It means to break the neck of an animal. God is just going to squash it there. He's just going to tear it all the way down and tear down all their idols and their sacred pillars and all of that. We, as most of you know, we just moved into a house back in September there. up north, 41st Avenue in Beardsley, and it's a subdivision being built. And about two streets down from us there, during that, after that horrible storm in August there, you know, the big one, the really big one, we had some other ones too, but there was a house, and it was the wood frame going up, and after the storm, that thing had collapsed. And it looked like a big hand had just come down and just like that, because it was just, all the boards were everywhere, all the wood was everywhere. And funny thing was, when they started rebuilding that, whoever the carpenter, the person working on it, put up a little cross on the garage front there, I guess for divine protection. Well, at any rate, you know, it was torn down as the house was continued to be constructed that. But to realize that God is not going to tolerate their idolatry, He's going to destroy, He's going to break it down. And then verse 3, surely now they will say, the Israelites, we have no king, for we do not revere the Lord. As for the king, what can he do for us? As a result of the punishment in verse 2, they will realize that they do not have a king sanctioned by God, that is a Davidic ruler, and they do not revere or respect God. Hoshea is the king, but again, he's not a legitimate king for Israel. He is from another realm. They had rejected their heavenly king, so now they only have their human king to go to for help. Then they will realize that their human king is helpless to help them. What can the king do? Absolutely nothing. You see, we put such a premium on what our political leaders can do for us, and yet there's really nothing in the ultimate sense that they can do for us. The issue is, how can God help us, and what can God do to help us? And there's a principle here. If you reject God's help in life, there is no other help available. If you reject God's help, there is no other help available. He is the only Savior. He is the only help. And to realize that when man tries to solve man's problems apart from God, that's called what? Evil. It's called the satanic plan of evil. Satan used his genius to try to revolt against God, but he also uses his genius as a strategy called evil to try to solve all of man's problems and all of his problems, as it were, apart from God. And when we get into that, it is called evil. And of course, the issue is that we should seek God for his help. I've always enjoyed this quote from Abraham Lincoln during the very dark days, some of the very darkest days of the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln was asked by someone if he was convinced that God was on the side of the Union. He replied, "Sir, my concern is not whether God is on our side. My great concern is to be on God's side." And you see, again, God doesn't move. We need to be on His side. Well, if you look at verse 3, we have no king, for we do not revere the Lord. As for the king, what can he do for us? If you insert president for king, you have our present national situation. Everyone wants to know what the president will do for us, or any other elected official. They all want to know, what will the person do for me? What will they do for us? You know, they appeal to big God government, how I like to phrase it. We look at the government, we say, what can the government do for me? How can it help me out? How can it solve my problems? In reality, we're looking at the wrong place. We should be looking to God for help and to realize the true role of government. And what is that role of government? Well, to realize that government is to protect our freedom. It is to protect our freedom. We have freedom guaranteed to us by the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. We have certain inalienable rights, our founders said, endowed to us, given to us by the Creator. And those rights were not given to us by man. They're given to us by God. And therefore, government, as they conceived of, was to protect those rights. And whether you're talking about the rights that are found in the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, the freedom of speech, the freedom of religion, the freedom of bear arms, the freedom to be free from illegal search and seizure and property seizure and so forth, all of these different things, the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, all of these different things were problems that the Founding Fathers had dealt with England. And they had their freedoms attacked, their rights attacked because of that. But to realize that politicians will come to everybody and they'll say, I want to do this for you, I want to do that for you. And the issue is, well, maybe as we should even think, I'm not a big fan of JFK, but ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. To see that we have this entitlement mentality, the idea that everybody owes us something, and you know, the government owes us something. We have entitlements now. All these different things that have come up. And so we keep asking the question, what can you do for me? Well, government, again, is to protect us, to help us guard freedom. and of course to protect our freedom to fail or succeed. Maybe what we should ask, what should government be doing? Let me give you a few examples of things that you'll hear this on the news these days. Let me give you a few solutions that we see, and give you maybe an alternative. Who's in favor of pornographic art? Wow. Should the government be funding pornographic art? No. That's a big debate that's going on, right? You know, it has for years at least. You know, pornographic, obscene art. And everybody's getting upset. The government should not be funding this. May I submit to you that the government should not be funding good art, bad art, ugly art, or pornographic art? Simple solution, but we don't seem to think about it that way. You see, the government's job is not to fund art, which is using your taxpayer dollars, my taxpayer dollars to do that. The issue is, it should protect my freedom and your freedom to walk down to the Phoenix Art Museum to go see art. And the very fact that you and I can't do that without fear of being mugged, raped, assaulted, and murdered means that government has failed its basic responsibility. Now, let me bring up another one. Heard this on the radio a couple weeks ago, but it's a big issue. You see it on 60 Minutes, all these shows and that. The convicted child molesters who are released from prison, should they or should they not be reported to the community? Wow, that's a big one. And of course, you have people, you know, concerned parents saying, no, I mean, yes, they should be reported to the community. We should have a record that this person has now moved into our area and is living here. Then you have the other people, of course, represented by the civil rights libertarian type movement. Oh, no, this is a violation. And, you know, good arguments are presented in both cases, and they've served their time and so forth. Guess which one is right? Neither one. Because the Bible says someone like that should be executed, put to death. So it doesn't matter if you want to say so-and-so is in the community or not. You may say his grave is in the community. Who cares about that? If he was buried there, no big deal. But you see, we have lost divine viewpoint. We're no longer thinking in divine solution. We're thinking about arguing this little petty part of it. Should we report his name to the community or not? Oh my goodness, hours of conversation and dialogue on talk radio about this. No, these are people along with rapists and kidnappers and murderers and all these different people pictured by God in the Old Testament that we as society should look at and say, they have gone way beyond what is called rehabilitation. They need to have justice performed against them. They need to be executed, removed from society. And we'll talk about that a little bit more tonight. By the way, since I didn't say in the introduction, this is a good time to take a break for a moment, get a breath here. But tonight, continuing back with Hosea chapter 4, we're going to talk about murder and capital punishment. And don't be fooled. The Bible absolutely, dogmatically commands capital punishment, the death penalty. And I say that because so many Christians are so messed up with this regard. They think that it is unchristian or non-loving or whatever they want to say to execute someone. Well, we'll go through all the arguments and all of this information, Old and New Testament, and to realize what I put on the back pew over here is a preliminary sheet on it, free for you to take. Objections to philosophical and religious objections to capital punishment. It's something I put out years ago, but I made you copies because I won't have the time to go through all these different things. But I have tried to take every objection that people have put forth on this subject and answer that, both philosophically and biblically there. So please take advantage of that and pick that up on the way out. But to realize, what can the king do for us? What will the president do for us? What will this elected person do for us? That's what we keep asking. And we lose track of the real solution to these things. Now, this whole thing here, surely now they will say, we have no king, for we do not revere the Lord. As for the king, what can he do for us? I want to take a few moments, and time is running out on me as it is, but to look at something that, to touch on something that we have looked at in the last couple Sundays with King David, a situation that happened in his life. And I'm not going to look at it from the standpoint of divine discipline as we've been talking about, but from the standpoint of how people come to power and to show you what they do to gain power, to gain the support of people, and not in a legitimate, moral, or ethical way. So if you would turn, please, we're going to go to 2 Samuel for this, back to the story of David, his continuing saga here, chapter 13. I want to show you how Absalom came to power and how he abused it, how he used it, and how he lost it here. Second Samuel chapter 13. And realize if I talked with Pastor Miller before he left, and if I overlap, that's part of review, but I don't think we will here, because he was covering the subject from the divine discipline standpoint and the stages of installment discipline that David went through, of course. But here we see one of the aspects of divine discipline that David suffered, excuse me, and that was with his beloved son Absalom. Absalom was his favorite son, his beloved son, someone that David just could not get over here. He had such problems with Absalom, and they really came back to David. David did not handle things as a father the way he should have. As king, he did not handle the way things should have gone. And so Absalom had problems, and of course those overflowed to David. And Absalom was even used by God as part of this discipline, not only the revolt that happened, but of course the fact that Absalom did fulfill God's prophecy. David had slept with Bathsheba in private, and of course David predicted, or God predicted, that part of that discipline would be that someone would sleep with his wives in public, and that was fulfilled by Absalom there before he died. He did come to a rise in power, and then it was taken away or put down. But I want to give you a little bit of the background here and show you some of the mental attitude sins that build up here. And as Absalom develops his conspiracy here, notice 2 Samuel chapter 13, verses 37 through 39, please. Now Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, the king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom had fled and gone to Geshur and was there 3 years. In the heart of King David longed to go out to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, since he was dead. Now remember, in this story, Amnon had raped Absalom's sister Tamar, and of course Absalom had his way of getting back. He did murder Amnon to get back for that rape. And of course that is found in the previous chapters. But something happens to Absalom. He snaps here. He gets so bitter. We don't know exactly, we're not given details, but during those 2 years, he longed to come back and be restored to the kingdom. And yet, that is David's kingdom, and yet he was not. And he was put off, he was pushed away by King David. And Absalom developed a great deal of bitterness here. And then notice, if you would turn please, I'm going to skip around through some verses because I don't have the time, you know, to read verse by verse. But 2 Samuel chapter 14, starting with verse 21. 2 Samuel chapter 14, verse 21 and following. Then the king said to Joab, and of course Joab was David's chief of staff, "Behold now, I will surely do this thing. Go therefore, bring back the young man Absalom." And to summarize, the woman of Tekoa came by Joab's orders and related a little story to David. And so David, and all that was designed to talk about Absalom and to get him restored. And Joab, verse 22, fell on his face to the ground, prostrated himself, and blessed the king. "Today," and then Joab said, "today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, O my lord, the king, and that the king has performed the request of his servant." Verse 23, so Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. So Absalom returned to Jerusalem, and what is David's response in verse 24? "I'm so glad to see you. It's been so long, Absalom." Verse 24, "However, the king said, let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So Absalom turned to his own house and did not see the king's face." See, what David is doing here, he's practicing half forgiveness. He wants him to come back, but he fails to be reconciled to him and to completely forgive and forget about this. And you see, he offered Absalom only half forgiveness. You know, he should be happy to see his favorite son, his beloved son. "Absalom, you're back." You know, like the prodigal son, the story in Luke chapter 15, should just run out. David should run out like the whole story there with open arms and hug his son. "My son who is lost has returned, and let's prepare a feast for him." Instead, David is pouting himself. He's still sore about it. He hasn't really forgiven, and he doesn't want to see him. And this is a real slap in the face to Absalom. I mean, imagine, you come back after a long time, and you're ignored, you're pushed away. And so David is practicing half-forgiveness here. He wants to have relations with David. He's not considered part of the royal cart. And David, of course, should have forgiven as God forgives, that is to not remember the sin or the offense. And, of course, we might say that half-forgiveness is no forgiveness at all. Why? Because it adds hypocrisy to the whole thing, dishonesty. And so, at any rate, David has not forgiven him. He thinks he has, but he's simply ignoring him. He's just insulted him in every way by doing this. Verse 25, "Now in all Israel was no one as handsome as Absalom, so highly praised, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. There was no defect in him. And when he had cut the hair of his head, and it was at the end of every year that he cut it, for it was heavy on him, so he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels by the king's weight." So we find he was a long-haired hippie from the 60s there. So at any rate, you know, it was acceptable, I guess. I would have cut it long before then, but I'm not in the story. So at any rate, "And to Absalom there was born 3 sons and 1 daughter, whose name was Tamar. She was a woman of beautiful appearance." Now, we're not told, at least in this account, Absalom's wife, but we do find that things started to return to normal. He had 3 sons and a daughter. And notice, usually in biblical accounts of births and genealogy, the sons are always emphasized, the daughters very seldom. But here, Tamar, he named his daughter Tamar in honor of his sister, who, of course, had been raped. Verse 28, so everything seems to be going along. "Now Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face." You know, this is the kind of situation where you're walking down the street and one's on one side and one's on the other. I mean, you live in Jerusalem, it's not that big a city. How are you going to miss meeting into one another and bumping into one another? David is avoiding and ignoring Absalom. He doesn't want to see him. He thinks that he's forgiven him, but he is not. And of course, this just forms bitterness and hostility and implacability for Absalom. He became bitter and angry. And what a tragedy. Absalom was David's favorite son, and yet David and Absalom were estranged. All this time, they're living in the same city for 2 years. And of course, 2 years have passed, and they should have gotten this all straightened out. This is 2 years added to the previous 5 years. So we're talking about a total of 7 years here. And the principle is unresolved problems just get worse. They just get worse. They do not get better over time. And then verse 29, "Then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. So he sent again a second time, but he would not come. Therefore he said to his servant, 'See, Joab's field is next to mine. He has barley there. Go set it on fire.' So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose, came to Absalom at his house, and said to him, 'Why have your servants set my field on fire?' And Absalom answered Joab, 'Behold, I sent for you, saying, Come here that I may send you to the king to say, Why have I come from Geshur? It would have been better for me still to be there. Now therefore, let me see the king's face, and if there is iniquity in me, let him put me to death.'" See, you know, Absalom has some sense here. It's like, why did David bring me back just to ignore me? I would have been better off there. I would have at least been away from this and had time to heal and just start, continue with my own family and my own profession and so forth. So again, Absalom has some sense here. "So when Joab came to the king and told him, he called for Absalom. Thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face to the ground," to the ground before the king, "and the king kissed him." Now I want you to realize something here. This might appear that they made up, they kissed and made up, so to speak. No, this is formality. This was courtly, royal formality here. This was very cordial. It was simply formal respect. David did not show any outward sign of forgiveness or love, but, I mean, he showed outward forgiveness, but inside he had not forgiven him. And look at the things. Realize, if David had executed Amnon in the first place, when he had raped Tamar, a capital offense, Absalom would not have had reason to have gone after Amnon and killed him himself. And with the result that Absalom would not have had to flee the whole situation. So because David did not execute justice in the first place, as he should have by the Mosaic Law, this whole thing has just snowballed and snowballed till it is just in a terrible state. And then in 2 Samuel chapter 15, verse 1, we see what happens. All this bitterness and hostility finally builds up in Absalom. And he is to realize that he may not be so much of a troublemaker himself, but what he does is it makes him ripe. It makes him open to the suggestions of others. And we have to realize when we're in sin, especially all the things of bitterness and hostility, it makes us very open to bad advice in life, and to think about things that we would never do otherwise. And remember, part of the prophecy, part of the punishment on David was, violence will never depart from your dynasty, from your house. And so this is a continued fulfillment of this. So Absalom and his bitterness becomes an easy target for the conspirators. And there are always conspirators around. They want to try to take over power. And so they find that here is someone who is open to their suggestions. And when I read this years ago, it just floored me. I just happened to realize, it just floored me. If I had been sitting down, I would have fallen down, because it's like, this is today's paper. This is how people work in their conspiracy of power. Read with me, please, 2 Samuel 15:1. This is Absalom again. He's being sought by these people. Now it came about after this that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. Now why does he do this? He wants public attention. This is drawing attention to him and what's going on, and it stirs an interest about what he's doing. And remember, we already know that Absalom is a beautiful specimen of the human race. Physically, he is just adorable as a man, whatever that means. But all the hair and all that stuff, whatever that. But he was a good-looking guy there. He was quite a dude here, as they say today. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And it happened that when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And he would say, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Now, to realize here, the gates of the city were the place of judging court cases. That's what it means here. They're bringing suits, little cases, small claims court type of thing. And realize that Absalom made himself, he got up early, he made himself available to anyone coming by. And the comparisons between this right here and political campaigning are just incredible, to realize what politicians do. You know, they have to get everybody's attention. They have to, give the personal touch. And I'm not against the personal touch per se, but when you do it for the wrong reason, simply to get that vote, that power, rather than doing what is right, it becomes wrong. And realize here, it's just kind of like, going around shaking hands, kissing babies. Absalom is just doing all the right moves here to get their attention. And notice this, Absalom did not have to govern the affairs of state every day like King David. See, David doesn't have this time. He's a ruler. He's still the king of Israel. He is devoting his time to the affairs of state. Absalom has time to do this. And what he is doing here is, he is simply saying, "Oh, I feel your pain. You're right. I understand. David's not taking care of you." Verse 3, "Then Absalom would say to him, 'See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king.'" And you see here, Absalom implied that David was just too busy to hear them. And furthermore, David had failed to appoint judges to hear their claims. And notice his remark here, "Your claims are good and right." You see, whether they were right or not doesn't matter. He was just saying this to gain their support. He shows sympathy for their problems. But in reality, he's not really concerned. He's looking for a power brace. "Oh, too bad. Oh, I'm so sorry David hasn't gotten to that matter yet. Oh, just too terrible. This really sounds like an important thing, and I just don't understand why they didn't get to this. And certainly you are right about this. You are being treated so unfairly by David not taking care of this issue." And it touches people in the way where they gain support. And Absalom goes on, basically, "Yes, I'll take care of your problem. I'll help you with this. Oh, of course, you're right. Absalom, you're absolutely right. I think I will support you. David's not helping me at all." And this is how people build up their base of power. And of course, to realize in the political realm, we have this today all the time. People don't want to talk about doing the right thing because the right thing may not be popular, whether it's balancing the budget or doing this or doing that, to have fiscal responsibility, all these different things that we talk about. People don't want to do that because it might offend people, it might lose their power, and realize something, votes equal power. Votes equal power. It's not a matter of simply, "Oh, well, I'm just going to get into office." No, these people come along and they try to get your vote, and that vote is being exchanged for power. They don't want money necessarily, they want power. And they're on a power lust trip, and that's what they will do with it at times. Verse 4, "Moreover, Absalom would say, 'Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause could come to me, and I would give him justice.'" So here it is, translation. You give me a vote, I'll get you justice. I'll get the power here. I'll give you what you want if you give me what I want. And it doesn't make any difference whether it was just or not, fair or not, right or not, but a matter of just simply getting the power, getting the vote here. And so this is how Absalom comes to power. And he may not have started out that way, but that bitterness and all these things just combined to bring him to this point. And it happened, verse 5, that when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. And so Absalom follows up with personal respect by a kiss. And again, he wasn't homosexual. It was just a matter of this was the order of the day. His friendly embraces were designed to win power. And in this manner, verse 6, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. He built up his power base, and we have three groups here. You have Absalom. He's bitter. You have the people who are flocking to him. They're bitter because their desires are not being met. And then you have the conspirators, and I'll just abbreviate this, but the conspirators, all the people running around, and they are going to become advisors to Absalom, and they are the ones who want power. They're jealous of power, and they want to get power. And they're going to, it's just a three-way circus at this point, three-ring circus. The idea that they're going to, but it's not funny at all, like the circus is. The conspirators and Absalom people are all going to join together in this very evil mixture and gain power. And from this, a revolution is going to occur with the result that David will have some of the greatest trouble he's ever had. Now, it came about, verse 7, at the end of 40 years, it should be 4 years here, there's a textual problem. You know that this isn't talking about 40 years later. That Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron." And Hebron, of course, is the place where Absalom was born. David started there. And then verse 8, "For your servant vowed a vow while I was living in Geshur and Aram, saying, if the Lord shall indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. And the king said to him, go in peace. So he arose and went to Hebron." Was this an innocent trip? No. "But Absalom," verse 10, "sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron. Then 200 men went with Absalom from Jerusalem, who were invited, and went innocently, and they did not know anything. And Absalom sent to Ahithophel, the Gibeonite, or Gilonite, David's counselor from his city, Gilah, while he was offering the sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. Then a messenger came to David, saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. And David said to all of his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us shall escape from Absalom. Go in haste, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. Then the king's servants said to the king, behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord, the king, chooses. So the king went out and all of his household with him, but the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. And the king went out and all the people with him, and they stopped at the last house. Now all of his servants passed on beside him, all the Kerethites, all the Pelethites, and all the Gittites, 600 men who had come with him from Gath, passed on before the king." Now, there's a full-fledged revolution going. David is fleeing for his life from the city. Turn to chapter 16, please. Just a few more verses here as we run out of time. Finish up this morning. Remember what I said? When you have this weakness, it opens up you up to bad advice. Notice chapter 16, verse 20. Ahithophel was David's spiritual advisor as such, but he had gotten into this conspiracy. He was disappointed in something and became bitter, and all of a sudden he's involved in this, and he's supporting Absalom. Absalom is not the heir to the throne. Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, "Give your advice, what shall we do?" Absalom is weak here. He's now been so weakened. He has shown some sense before, but now he is so weak. He is so filled with bitterness and discouragement, disappointment, that he is ready to do anything, and he's simply asking. He's not really a leader in himself, but he's asking for advice. And Ahithophel gives some real spiritual advice here. Said to Absalom, "Go into your father's concubines. Remember the 10 that were left, concubines, whom he has left to keep the house. Then all Israel will hear that you have made yourself odious to your father. The hands of all who are with you will also be strengthened." So, he didn't do it. No, they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. And again, this fulfills the predicted judgment of 2 Samuel chapter 12. David did it in private, but Absalom will do it in public here, in total view of Israel. And realize that Absalom had no moral courage, no strength of character to refuse such a thing, but he is filled with bitterness and conspiracy, and he is simply ripe for whatever others will suggest to him. Well, 2 Samuel 18, verses 31 and 33 give us what happened to Absalom, to make a long story short here, of course, to realize that Absalom was, in fact, put down in his revolution. Chapter 18, verse 31, "And behold, the Cushite arrived, and the Cushite said, 'Let my lord the king receive good news, for the Lord has freed you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you.'" Now realize that King David is only concerned about one person here. He's only concerned about one, Absalom. "Then the king said to the Cushite, 'Is it well with the young man Absalom?'" How do you answer the king with bad news? "And the Cushite answered, 'Let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be as that young man.'" You know, the Cushite here has integrity. He's saying, your enemies should be the same as him. And that's the right attitude. But of course, David now is grieving. He had missed all of his opportunities through the year to have a friendship and a good relationship with Absalom. But now that he's dead, now he wants to have a good relationship with him. "And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And thus he said as he walked, 'O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son.'" And then going on into verse 19, just for a couple of verses here, notice this. "Then it was told Joab, 'Behold, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom. And the victory that day was turned to mourning for all the people, for the people heard it that day, or said that day, the king is grieved for his son.'" You know, I had a great victory, put the revolution down, and here is David sulking and pouting over his son, the son that he wouldn't even see for 2 years in Jerusalem. And he just missed his total opportunity because of his sin and the sin of Absalom. "So the people went by stealth into the city that day, as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle. And the king covered his face and cried out with a loud voice, 'O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son.'" And Joab, in this whole account, these whole accounts here, is the only one that seems to have any kind